Good afternoon and welcome to the LaRouche Show. It's Saturday, February 5th, 2011. I'm Harley Schlanger and I will be your host. This week, members of the LaRouche Youth Movement, led by the six members of the LaRouche National Candidate Slate, took up the opportunity created by the publication of the report by the Angelides Committee to escalate the organizing on the state level to pressure the otherwise brain-dead U.S. Congress to reinstitute Glass-Steagall banking regulations. The Angelides Committee, known officially as the Financial Crisis Inquiry Commission, produced a report based on 2 years of investigation, which included a number of interviews, which should be read by every citizen. This commission is an official commission of the United States government, and in its report, it tells the truth about the crisis, which exploded in the summer of 2007. That the crisis was both foreseeable and could have been prevented, as Lyndon LaRouche had both forecast it and repeatedly offered solutions to the developing economic collapse. Secondly, that it was the result of a more than 30-year process of a deliberate attack on the American system, an attack specifically on the revival of the American system in the 1930s by President Franklin Roosevelt. Third, that it escalated in 1999 with the repeal of Glass-Steagall in the form of the lamentable Graham-Leach-Bliley bill, and that that was led by Federal Reserve Chairman Alan Greenspan, who the report demonstrates was incompetent as a forecaster and criminally malicious as an administrator. And fourth, that the actions since September 2008 by both the Bush and Obama administrations, especially the continuation of the bailouts, not only failed to reverse the crisis, but that nothing done since then, including the fraudulent Dodd-Frank bill for reform of the financial system, will prevent the next crisis. We will be discussing this report on the program today. Note that Lyndon LaRouche stated today that the survival of our nation, the United States, depends on citizens of this country understanding the implications of this report and knocking some sense into the heads of elected officials so they too will study it and draw the proper conclusions. And on today's program, we're going to help them do that. Also today, we have a memo that was written last night by Lyndon LaRouche, How Can Europe Be Saved?, in which he writes that the nations of Europe, which are collapsing along with the United States, that is the whole euro system and its dummy currency, the euro, are going through an accelerated disintegration as a result of the same long-term change away from the American system, but that the nations of Europe can still be saved by finishing off the bankrupt British Empire, by reinstating Glass-Steagall, and by establishing a credit system which would allow for the growth of real physical production in the United States and Europe. Joining me today on the program to discuss this report and the battle to defeat the British Empire and restore the American system will be Summer Shields, who's one of the six LaRouche Democratic congressional candidates in the United States. Summer is running in the 8th Congressional District of California against the former House Speaker and now House Minority Leader Nancy Pelosi. Also with us will be Stefan Tolksdorf, the leader of the newly established electoral slate of the BUSO, the LaRouche Party in Germany, and he's running for mayor of the city-state of Berlin. So Summer and Stefan, welcome to the program.
Hi, Harley.
Hi, Harley. Thank you.
Stefan, let me begin with you, because you spoke last Saturday at your party day of the mission of your slate and of our campaign. What do you intend to do with this campaign, and why is this so important, not just for Berlin, but for Germany, for Europe, and for the world?
Well, Harley, that's exactly the right way to look at it, because the discussions that we had prior to this party convention last Saturday was obviously what can you actually do in a situation like that with what is usually kind of a clown show of an election in Berlin, where the only thing meaningful that has happened so far were campaigns that we have done. Now, Berlin, for those who don't live here, they should know that the city is bankrupt. The city of Berlin alone has about 63 billion euros of debt. So that's close to the ratio of Ireland, with a slightly bigger population than Berlin, and 80 billion euros. And also a somewhat ironical voice recently penned an article where this person called Berlin the Mogadishu of Europe, for the simple fact that transportation system, which is vital for that city, has in large part ceased functioning either during heat waves in the summer or because of snow in the winter or simply because the wheels fell off. And so it's Berlin as such is a kind of a dead place where nothing really happens. And so what we have decided to do is take a, you know, in the LaRouchean sense, a somewhat more arrogant approach, which is the following. Berlin, being the capital of Germany, also makes the mayor of Berlin the host of the German government. And as the host of the German government, there is something that an acting and sitting mayor could actually do. So we have decided to assume that function because the government right now in Germany is confused. They are, you know, characterized on the one hand by sometimes you have attempts to, you know, regain kinds and or parts of national sovereignty, or at least an unwillingness to give it up, vis-a-vis the, you know, the attempts by the European Commission and other imperial agencies to destroy it. And then also on the other hand, the government has been so far going along with the bailouts, with the creation of this European Financial Stability Facility in Luxembourg, of all places, so it could be outside of European, of EU law. So the government is confused, and I say that for a specific reason. I had the fortune, or misfortune, as you want to call it, to have been in a meeting with a high-ranking member in the German Bundestag not too long ago in December, and at some point during the discussion, this is obviously before we had the great news of the Angelides report, we briefed this person on the Pecora Commission and kind of urged the discussion in that direction. And at some point, he said the following: we have no concept and we have no solution. And that is pretty much very, very true. So we decided to set up a slate of now 20 candidates, which I am heading, but we're not going to use the campaign to do kind of district organizing or anything that goes down. Our campaign is organized upward and focused on providing the German government with a solution in this very, very dangerous period.
So you're taking the usual approach of the LaRouche movement from the top down.
Yes.
Because the top is missing.
Exactly. And people do react to that very, very positively, because if you're honest enough and tell them that that's what the situation is, they actually, usually they tell us that we're right. They don't expect anything, anything big to happen from one of the other parties. And I should also mention that the parties here in Berlin are pretty much all falling apart. I mean, sometimes, you know, when people call us a small party because we have less members than the others and so far much less votes, you can almost give that back to them and tell them that, you know, the SPD and the CDU, at least the regional organizations here in Berlin, you know, they're becoming splinter groups, so to speak.
Well, or they exist as a shell where they have a party structure, but they have no brains, which is even harder to exist.
Yeah.
You know, you mentioned this question of no conception and no solution. I think you remember when I was there, I attended a French-German economic summit where people agreed with the idea in principle of Glass-Steagall and also agreed that the euro is dead, but then defended the euro and defended the floating exchange rate system. I get a sense that people are, in a sense, afraid to challenge the hegemony or the might of not just the European Commission, but obviously there's a recognition that there's a higher power. Do you think there's a sense yet that the German government is being called on to bail out the City of London and that the problem is the City of London? Are you getting a sense of that yet?
I'm not sure. What's definitely there is pretty much an obvious recognition that if you look at these, take the six countries that right now have a so-called AAA credit rating, being France, Germany, the Netherlands, Finland, and Austria, And you just look at these countries, and then you look at the rumors that France might very soon lose this credit rating, then what's left? You know, you look at, you compare the economies of Austria, of the Netherlands, Finland, you know, to Germany, and I mean, that's pretty obvious that that Germany is kind of the last man standing there, the country that's supposed to bail out everything. And that recognition is for sure there. And you have to poke people, obviously, a little bit, especially when, you know, the chancellor or the finance minister of Germany go to London and they have important discussions with the prime minister of the United Kingdom. And then you ask them, why do we have to discuss these things with a country that's not even in the euro? And why are they so adamant about everyone else staying in? And that usually cracks it open a little bit.
Now, I'd like to ask you about something that we reported this morning. I don't know if you saw this or not, but that Handelsblatt, one of the leading financial papers in Germany, had coverage from their Washington, D.C. correspondent, which clearly indicated, even though he didn't reference the Angelides report, indicated the conclusions or presented the conclusions of that report. Are we getting a recognition yet, or are we? How are we using the Angelides report in our organizing in Berlin and in Germany as a whole?
Well, first, when we put it out on our posters and picket signs and, you know, leaflets, the reaction wasn't so very much, for the simple fact that people have no idea what this is or why it is important. And some people, I mean, a lot of people are also a bit depressed, and, you know, they ask, okay, so, well, that was in the past, the crisis is, this is all about the past, who cares? So we, you know, refocused a little bit, and we told people that this is a scandal about the press, because it's the press that is actually suppressing this. They're talking it down. They're saying that it's of no relevance, that it's inconclusive, and so on and so forth. So that has changed a little bit. And actually today we had from the organizing somewhat of an interesting anecdote where one of our organizers went into a bakery to warm up a little bit, and she was reading in our printed briefing a report that we have here as a draft comparing what Lynn has said over the last 30, 40 years with the Angelides report, and obviously those things that came from more other official circles like the U.S. government at the same time. So that person sitting next to our organizer kept peeking into that report, and at some point he asked, is this about this American financial crisis report? Is that what you're reading there?
Huh.
And she replied, yeah, yeah, it's excerpts. And the guy was highly curious. Turns out it's an Austrian guy. Immediately left his contact and said, I have to read this. I think this is very important. So something is obviously seeping through.
Well, and on this, I'd also like to ask you, because in the U.S. we're still getting reports that the administration is saying the crisis is over, the economy's in good shape, and the example, of course, is the Dow Jones going above the 12,000 level. Even while they're reporting increased numbers of people losing jobs, the housing situation is a disaster, and so on. Now, the German government is putting out the same line. In fact, the whole of the EU is saying Germany is strong, its exports are up, Germany's in the middle of a robust recovery. Why don't you tell us the actual situation, and do people believe this propaganda?
No, they don't. I mean, the people who say that and the people who seem to believe it are those who want to believe it for some weird reason, because they have personal stakes in there. But, you know, normal people that you talk to, and it's not, it doesn't have to be, you know, you don't have to talk to unemployed and homeless people to find out. You talk to pretty much everyone. Nobody believes that because nobody sees it. There is no... there's no sign that anything is going forward. Quite the contrary. The small enterprises, small entrepreneurs are complaining about the banking regulation that came with Basel III. There is widespread recognition that nothing is really happening. And some, I mean, if you look at the composition of these jobs that we're talking about now, that we have all of a sudden so many of, the productive part of these jobs is probably half of, in terms of ratio, is probably half of what it was in the 1980s and earlier. So you don't have to be a genius to recognize that. And most people do not believe it, because somehow the idea that you can, and it's easy, you can make a lot of jokes about this. Statistics, you can prove pretty much anything with statistics. You know, sometimes I told people when I talked with them, I said, if it's a woman, I said, you know, statistically, I could prove that you should be a man. You know, and it's a lot of blah, blah, blah.
I'm sure that's funnier in German.
Yeah, maybe.
Now, just one other question on this, and then I'm going to turn to Summer, but I want you to stick around because there's a lot more to talk with you about. But I'd like to ask you this. As Lyndon LaRouche has been warning, this bailout, both by the Federal Reserve, which is huge and continues even at an accelerated rate, along with the bailout of the European Central Bank, the European Union, where money is coming from sovereign governments like Germany to allegedly pay off Irish debt, but it's going to the British banks, all this money printing is hyperinflationary. And in the last 2 months, we've seen an explosion of food prices on a world scale. Mm-hmm. Is this beginning to happen in Germany? And given the remembrance almost embedded in the bones of the people of the 1923 Weimar hyperinflation, is this going to be something that we can expect a political reaction to?
I would think absolutely yes. There will be a reaction. We obviously also pointed out that the ratio of what people, the part of their salaries or monthly incomes that they have to spend on food is obviously much, much lower here. We're talking about 15% of your monthly income actually goes for food. There's much more expensive things like rent or gasoline. But then, you know, in Egypt or other countries where it goes up to 80-90%, it's obviously a different story. Now, people have recognized the price increases. I have to say, though, that with the consumer prices, the retail prices, and that might, I don't know how long it's going to take until it actually hits that, but some of the people we talked to that are dealing with raw material, you know, production, raw material shipping and so forth, they are warning about this because they're saying there is gigantic price increases and it's only a question of time once that hits the population. Now, obviously, that's a raw point, and I can just, it's a raw nerve. But there's two of these that we actually discuss, and I just want to throw that in here because with the end of December, our head of the party, Helga Zepp-LaRouche, launched a campaign against euthanasia. And, you know, within about a month, we had actual good results on that whole mobilization because the euthanasia is, like inflation, a very sore spot in the collective memory, so to speak, in the cultural memory of Germany. And I think if we do it the right way, then we can also snap people out of this one. Obviously, with inflation, it's an even greater fear because unlike euthanasia, it hits everyone. And so there is a certain block to talk about this. And the only way usually to get out of this is by actually presenting the fascinating concepts of LaRouche, of the basement, that we as a movement represent, what the future actually could look like if we get rid of this of these bailouts, and actually use all that money, because that's the only good thing that the crisis actually brought with it. This old argument that we don't have money for this or that is out of the window.
You're listening to Stefan Tolksdorf, who is the lead candidate in Berlin, Germany, of the Busso Party, the party of Helga Zepp-LaRouche, which is fielding a slate of candidates, and we'll be back with him in just a moment. I'd like to bring in now Summer Shields, who many of our listeners know from his campaign last year. He was one of three LaRouche Democratic congressional candidates. Now he's one of six. And Summer, you recently led a team into Sacramento, the capital of California. And I think maybe later in the show, you and Stefan can debate whether California or Berlin is more bankrupt. But clearly, what's being proposed for California and Berlin in both cases are budget cuts and more so-called green technology. And there's no solutions being presented by either Democrats or Republicans. You went in with the Angelides report and with LaRouche's plan for Glass-Steagall and NUAPA. What kind of response are you getting, and are you beginning to see in some circles, not just in the legislature but in the population, a recognition that we have to have a radical shift away from the going along to get along?
Well, we've seen a big shift, and it's exciting to hear Stefan talk about this report being the financial inquiry report being recognized in Europe. But I think that what we've seen is a huge shift in Sacramento, where now the discussion about whether or not the budget cuts are going to kill people has turned into the budget cuts are killing people. This is something that we recognize, but so far our hands are tied. We either have to raise taxes or cut the budget. And in a state like California, where, as you said, we don't know what's more bankrupt, Berlin or California, I guess it depends on how devalued the dollar or the euro is at this point. But people are recognizing more than ever that the discussion, that the decision of whether or not people will live or whether or not people will die is the discussion that's being had in the legislation, in the legislature. That more and more there's the realization that that's what the discussion is all about. And so it's kind of a unique situation for us because, as you know, we've been going up to Sacramento and warning these guys about this crisis for a very long time. And so now when we go inside of there, it's people are definitely forced to think in a real way about what it is that we're trying to do when we say that we need to go with a federal approach, because we've been saying a federal approach for years now. And so it's a very unique situation where I think that maybe this is jumping ahead a little bit, but we've been talking about this financial crisis inquiry report, that right now it hits particularly close to home when it comes to California, since Phil Angelides, the chairman of this, is the former Treasury Secretary of the state of California, and he also ran for governor of the state of California. So when we go into this area, and we're planning to go far more in depth in terms of the exposing of this financial inquiry report having been put forward, but when we go into these areas, we're getting a very definite, clear-cut response from people who are saying, who are at least excited in our initial phases to see that there's an official federal government report saying that LaRouche was right, essentially, that this financial crisis was knowable, that it came from a flawed philosophy, and that it's something that can be fixed by going back to Franklin Roosevelt's banking regulation standards.
Well, certainly Angelides is well known in California, and perhaps he learned something from his 2006 campaign, because in that campaign, even though he correctly identified Schwarzenegger, his opponent, as being someone who was trying to cut the budget to the point of killing people, and it wasn't working, his campaign was fairly weak. But this report, and I've had a chance to read it, this report is very strong on precisely those areas of identifying the philosophical roots, with Greenspan and others, of attacking government as opposed to giving government more power. Now, I'm interested then, Summer, when I recently wrote an article on how cutting the budget has been a complete failure in California, that in fact every time they cut the budget, the deficit keeps growing. Are there people in both parties now who are beginning to recognize that and realize you need something beyond the usual political practices?
Yeah, this is actually one of the more interesting things, is that you have Republicans who are now beginning to come out in California and admit that we need a federal solution. And the terms of the debate have really changed, because before, you used to have the debate about whether or not you should cut the budget, and it was pretty much across the board, cut the budget, when it came to the Republicans. And then if you brought up a federal maneuver, they said, oh, no, this is okay, we can't talk anymore, this is too outrageous almost. Their view was that this was a bit wild to even think that you'd have a federal intervention. But now it's pretty unanimous that everyone recognizes that there is going to have to be a federal approach. I mean, there's some people who are still holding on to you have to stay within the bounds of the state, but it's pretty clear to most people that it would be nice at least to have a Glass-Steagall approach.
Well, and Summer, so also, I think it's useful to point out that the amount of money each month that the Federal Reserve is creating as debt to purchase bonds from banks, in other words, the so-called quantitative easing too, what they're spending in 1 month, if they actually made that available as direct reimbursements or direct injections of money to the states, it would cover the deficits for all 50 states. So 1 month of the new debt that's being created by the Federal Reserve to give more money to the banks would actually do a lot of good. As LaRouche is saying, the money should be going to the states instead of to the bailout.
That's absolutely right, and I think one of the interesting things that Dave Christie, who's also the candidate we've got up in Washington, pointed out is that the initial report on how much the TARP was going to be, this federal bailout was going to be obligated to pay, was $24 trillion. And for half of 1% of the cost of that, we could have bailed out the states and easily, and it would have been less than the $150 or $180 billion that was committed to AIG in the initial phases of this crisis.
Right. Well, that just shows what the Angelides report said, which LaRouche has been saying for a long time, which is that this is not about helping people or running the country. It's about bailing out swindlers and crooks. Now, Stefan, you have a situation in Berlin. You mentioned the debt. Berlin used to have manufacturing. It used to be a fairly strong economy. To what extent has the collapse of the budget process been the same kind of thing, deindustrialization? And it seems to me, as a second part of that question, that the main opponent, the Greens there, are saying we haven't deindustrialized enough. So how are we going to take up that issue?
Well, I mean, you're right. Berlin has been a very, very strong production center. About 100 years ago or so, it was actually known as Electropolis, because about half of what is exported to the world in terms of electronic devices was produced here. And I recently learned that even after a discussion with Mr. LaRouche, who pointed out that Berlin has been a rail hub, and that it also was integrated into plans of setting up this German rail grid in the 19th century, plans which were actually never intended to be a connection inside and between German cities only, but rather something that would integrate the Eurasian continent, and that was as an intention that has been there from the beginning. Now, so Berlin, I recently learned, also produced a lot of locomotives that were shipped out of here. I think, well, after the fall of the wall, the fate that hit East Germany also hit Berlin. In other words, the industry that was here was largely taken down in the eastern part, and it disappeared at a somewhat slower rate in the western part. So I can only say there's areas here that still bear the names of great companies like AEG or there's other Siemens. I mean, these are not just little factory parks. These are gigantic. I mean, they're almost little parts of the city as such, which are now filled with media, with TV stations and things like that. So that is pretty obvious that is gone. And I remember a discussion that the then financial senator of Berlin, Sarrazin, was leading at a place here in the December 2002, where he and his dry, very boring and hard and harsh way described that Berlin would have to have at least 10 years of intense budget cutting and austerity policy to stop the growth of debt. So there was not even talk of refinancing or repaying anything. It was simply to stop the growth of debt. And so the city now has the same problems that a lot of other places have in the world, that after strong winters like this one last year, the roads are cracking up, the repairs are not coming along. For a lot of people, it's unbearable situations when you have snow and ice and the boardwalks aren't cleared. We had reports about pensioners who couldn't leave their homes for a month because they just didn't dare walk on all that ice. And so this is really insane. And now the Greens have come up with this great idea of reducing the speed limit inside the city to about 30 kilometers generally. And that has really, it has freaked a lot of people out. And I don't think they're all too popular, especially because the leading figure in the city here, this terrible woman who loves Prince Charles and who loves everything about the British monarchy, she writes that in her autobiography. And she's also called herself the alpha female, as some kind of an animal kingdom reference to the kind of leadership role that she thinks she has in the Green Party. I mean, she's not all too popular. Renate Künast is her name, or Kunast, which if you say that without this umlaut is actually much more funny also for us. But I can say that they're not too popular. What's popular, obviously, is this whole green ideology as such, you know, about solar and wind power, even though I do think a lot of people have their doubts.
But, you know, Stefan, I was just in Germany, and the month I was there, mm-hmm. I saw about 4 hours of sunshine, so the solar panels were not working, and the damn windmills were frozen.
Yeah, I haven't seen the sun since you were here.
So. Yeah, well, and meanwhile, the state is subsidizing this form of power at a huge level.
Yeah,
I wanted to ask you on the memo that Lyndon LaRouche wrote today, which I believe is up on the LaRouche PAC website on how can we save Europe. He had a reference back to Hermann Abs, who was involved with the Wirtschaftswunder, the economic miracle.
Yeah.
And, of course, the American system is not unknown in Germany. In fact, it was under Bismarck at the end of the 1870s that the American system was applied most famously in Germany to show the great potential of the idea of national banking, of directed credit, of protectionism, an end to free trade, and so on, and also the social welfare state. And Germany boomed in the 1880s and 90s, which is why the British have, in a sense, the British Empire has been punishing Germany since 1890. There was the brief period with the post-World War II period with the economic miracle, and then after reunification, once again, the British came in with the French and with poor George Herbert Walker Bush, that complete numbskull. They came in and they said, we'll only allow you to reunify if you accept the euro. So how do you find, how are we organizing people to get a resonance on this idea that we've done it before, we've broken with the British, we in Germany have had an industrial economy. Is that still there in the collective memory of people?
Well, it may be, but if it is, then it's rather hidden, because you also have to know, I mean, Bismarck is, you know, probably one of the most, in a weird way, one of the most slandered politicians, because whatever biography you read of him, somehow this whole reference to the American system isn't there. It just doesn't show up. And it showed pretty well when Helga Zepp-LaRouche a couple of years ago gave a presentation on the American roots of the Industrial Revolution in Germany, to a youth cadre school, to everyone's complete amazement at how this worked and the people were involved, who were involved, and also how it happened, because it's been, I mean, we won't have too much time to discuss that in depth, but we have, for instance, we've assembled for those people who do still read, we have assembled kind of a super weapon. We took Lynn's title, The Secret Economy, Das Geheimnis der Wirtschaft, as a title for a book where we put together principal writings by Mr. LaRouche. Then we have this presentation that I just mentioned in there that Helga gave. We have a very, very important writing in that context by Wilhelm von Kardorf, who was the person who was recruited out of free trade liberalism into the protectionist school of American economics. He was recruited to read Liszt, but especially Carey, and then became one of the main guys who pushed this kind of thing with Bismarck. So it's very, very powerful. But to just make a quick point on the question of the recent memory, at our party convention here, one of our other candidates, because there's two other election campaigns going, mm-hmm. With elections coming up in March,
sure.
Which will be in Baden-Württemberg in the south and Rheinland-Pfalz, shortly north of that. And our lead candidate from Rheinland-Pfalz, Barbara Spahn, gave a really very, very beautiful and powerful presentation of, I don't think it was more than 10 minutes, where she made one simple point, but in a very powerful way, about money. She was telling people about Roosevelt's recovery programs, and she said the principle behind that is that money doesn't have value. And here's how she proved it. She talked about the Marshall Plan, and the fact that Germany got less than half of the amount of money through the Marshall Plan than the United Kingdom. Now, this money was supposed to be handed to firms in form of credit, and it was supposed to be used to buy, I think, things from U.S. companies, raw material, machines, whatever they needed. However, once they would pay back the credit, that this refinance credit, so to speak, would not go back to the United States or to some other fund, but it would go back to the central bank of a country. That was the Marshall Agreement, and it was supposed to be paid back in the currency of the country. So, in other words, in Deutschmark here.
Mm-hmm.
Now, nobody has ever heard about a British economic miracle in the 1950s or 60s, but there was one in Germany, because what the British did is they used this kind of money and the credits that rolled back to the government from these Marshall money to balance their budget. And the approach in Germany was simply very different. The Kreditanstalt für Wiederaufbau, the Reconstruction Finance Corporation, used the money to loan again and again and again, including the interest, which was used to, you know, make new loans possible.
Well, isn't this is exactly what Mr. LaRouche is talking about, of the adoption today of a credit system rather than a monetary system.
Exactly. And Hermann Abs, the guy who was heading this bank, he actually wrote letters. He addressed companies directly, asking them to please come and get a credit from him because they were interested in having their production and their output grow. You know, things like farming machines, tractors, I mean, all these things that were needed in mass. And at that time, it wasn't much for export. It was to reconstruct Germany. So this
And we could do the same thing today, only at the same time we could do it as exporting for these great projects, such as the Eurasian Land Bridge, TransAqua, and so on.
Exactly. Yeah.
Now Summer, just as Stefan was describing this about Bismarck, I was thinking about the slanders against Franklin Roosevelt. You're living in a state that was built largely, at least in the southern part of the state, because of the infrastructure projects of Roosevelt, and then the grid included the defense sector, auto, and others, all of which is gone now, including we're losing the water in Southern California. But Lyndon LaRouche made the point that in the northern part of the state, we still have some of that in terms of industrial economy and so on. Are you finding that we are getting, having to reconstruct for people the sense of history, and are they getting it?
You know, in a sense, I think when we've been bringing up now WAPA, I think that in general, Californians who have been around for some time or people who are involved in agriculture, including some of the Republican offices we ran into who have been involved in agriculture, have been responding in a very big way to NAWAPA, because the concept of bringing water in and not just moving it from one location to another one, but turning it into a scientific project where you bring in one drop of water and you get three out of it through rainfall and the development of the climate, it intrigues people and it gets the imagination going. And so we've been getting a number of people who are responding well to that, especially people who come out of the Central Valley region, and that's not far from here in San Francisco, a few minutes away, or about an hour away or so, you're already there. So the huge response to it, we've gotten a big response from, I think, a lot of the districts that cover the area of the former really big agricultural region of California, which is still big but has been dissipated. We get a big response from it. And the idea of not just relocating water is a big deal for these people.
Mm-hmm. Well, you know, I'd like to actually turn now to an area which, again, is unique for the approach of Lyndon LaRouche, and I think bears directly on what both of you are doing with your slates, and that is the question of science and culture of a classical type versus the cabaret society, rock, sex, drug counterculture, which I think characterizes both the San Francisco area and Berlin. Now, you think on the one hand of Berlin in the more recent period of the culture, the science culture of Einstein and Planck, the great tradition from Mendelssohn and Schiller and Felix Mendelssohn in Berlin and the Beethoven, Brahms, and others, versus the cabaret society, and then today the absolutely horrendous anarchist culture. And you have the same thing in San Francisco. I'd like both of you to discuss a little bit the relevance of this issue in terms of what we have to do to create a new leadership to get these two nations out of this otherwise inevitable dark age. Why don't we start with you, Stefan?
Yeah. I mean, there's a kind of discussion that comes up very often from contacts or people who are kind of half engaged with our movement already, and they're trying to figure out how to organize best. And so what they're often saying is, because we come on there with great, great plans. I mean, you talk about the WAPA, the Eurasian Land Bridge. These are gigantic things, and we're talking about a real vision for a future, not just for tomorrow. And they're often saying, in German, you say, die Leute da abholen, wo sie sind. In other words, you have to pick up people from where they are. In other words, they're not going to get what you're talking about. It's too great. It's too fantastic. You know, it involves kind of all kinds of things that people don't understand and so forth. And some of the work that we've been doing here led me to think about it in a somewhat different way. We've been working a lot on Beethoven. I mean, Berlin, we've been doing a lot of work on Beethoven's music, especially the Ninth Symphony and now the Choral Fantasy, mm-hmm. and which also is a national product of the organization here. And it's you would call it maybe a bit of the musical basement. And if Beethoven had thought in that way that people bring up often, this guy would have written, you know, little dance music pieces for the courts, you know, instead of challenging his audience to come to a higher level. And it's a bit unfair to say that here on the phone, but those who want to, I think, can go to the Schiller Institute website and listen to the recording of the Ninth Symphony that we did. But I can tell everyone that we've presented this at a number of meetings starting November a year ago, and it had almost, I wouldn't say calculable, but you could predict it or forecast it. It had an effect on the audience that you could know in advance. They may have been as blocked or as, you know, emotionally underdeveloped as possible, but when you confronted them with that piece in this short space of 12, 13, 14, 15 minutes, people would change, and you would see that if you look in their faces. They would physically look differently. A lot of people had tears in their eyes. They were completely moved, and the whole perception of everything that happens after that, be it a long and you know, deep-going, you know, principled speech by Helga Zepp-LaRouche, long discussions, all of these things were taken up by people in a different way. And it was the same at this party convention last Saturday where we presented the Choral Fantasy. It was the same effect. People are completely excited, and they don't really know where it's coming from. But we're using it to, you know, to bring them in, to give them a living taste of something. When we say classical culture, we're not talking about, you know, wearing wigs and talking in a funny old-fashioned way. When we're talking about this, we mean something living that means something for people today and that can change them and make them much happier and better people.
Well, of course, this is the Germany that we want to see restored, the Germany of Beethoven and Bach, the Germany of Riemann and Einstein.
Yeah.
And I think this is where, if people don't quite understand this, this is why German electronics, German engineering, is so world-renowned, precisely because of this interconnection between the creative discoveries and the teaching of this method of creativity in science and the arts, which was part of the von Humboldt reforms that really transformed the world in the 19th century. So this is not just something that's a theory. You know, some people say, well, you have to have freedom so that you have the freedom of techno or rave or heavy metal. But that's the freedom to be turned into an animal. And what we're talking about is rediscovering a culture which gives people their full human creative potentials to act in the imitation or in the image of the creator. So I assume this is something that we'll continue with the choral work in everything we're doing with the campaigns in Germany.
Yeah, you bet. Sure.
Yeah. And Summer, you can say something about that in California, because most people think of San Francisco and they think of the dirty hippies on Haight-Ashbury, which I think is in your district, who haven't changed their socks since 1968.
I'll spare you the details on their socks.
Well, please do.
Well, actually, I will say what Stefan's bringing up is very inspiring, because I think that bringing that kind of cultural atmosphere to the people of San Francisco is something we're going to have to do and present it on that level, because I think there's something in classical music composition, it's clearly something in classical music composition that nothing else can present to people in that fashion, and you're communicating something that no one, many people here or in Berlin have never experienced before. Mm-hmm. And it's a true sense of what a human being ought to be doing and what human beings, when they're not corrupted, will do. And I think that from my vantage point in San Francisco, a lot of people do think about it. They think of the dirty hippies, and many of them are still here, and they think of the drug rock sex culture, and that is here definitely too. But the history of Franklin Roosevelt in this city, I think, is important, and it's something I keep going back to. But it's something since I don't teach us anything in the schools here, when I first came to realize the importance of San Francisco as an international city, a city that reaches across the Bering Strait into the Pacific and into the nations of Asia, and really an international city that spans the entire planet, was when I was walking through a region of San Francisco that generally is filled with a lot of homeless people, a lot of drug addicts, and people who are leftovers, burnout from the 1960s. And I was looking on the ground, and I was looking at a series of lists of countries and years next to them that were engraved into the ground in the region of downtown San Francisco. And I looked up at one of the pillars, and I realized that it was this very place where the United Nations had been founded. And I had walked through this area several times, and I had no idea that this is the location where the founding conference of the United Nations was. And you really realize that the operation of the British Empire against the culture of the United States began very early on, because Franklin Roosevelt died shortly before the convening of that conference. But his plan was to discuss the ushering in of the age of the atom as a critical point of departure of the United States once the World War II ended. And that was the idea of Roosevelt, was to say that the scientific revolution for humanity was going to be in the development of the atom. And you see that even till this very day, due to the countercultural push and the cultural collapse of the baby boomer generation and the successive collapse after that, you see that there was a huge delay in any sort of real scientific research that was devoted to the development of the atom and from fission to fusion power. And that cultural importance of San Francisco and the history that stems back to Franklin Roosevelt, and even before, a history of its crucial role on the West Coast in defending the United States.
Even the Transcontinental Railroad, San Francisco was the end point on that, the goal of Lincoln or John Quincy Adams to connect the continent.
That's absolutely right. Yeah, this whole history stemming all the way back to the beginning of the nation, actually. And the Transcontinental Railroad is a perfect example. That's what we're bringing to people. And it's inspiring, I think, for people to hear that San Francisco isn't just a place where a bunch of hippies got dirty and wore their socks for too long.
Well, I think, Summer, also we can talk about the importance of your campaign last time in bringing up this four powers concept, because if we take seriously, and we have to, what Lynn said today, that we have to use the Angelides report to end the bailout, to bring in Glass-Steagall, and to establish the fixed exchange rate system that will allow for the development of nations, as opposed to the hyperinflationary bailout policy, which is destroying nations such as Tunisia, Egypt, Jordan, Ireland, Italy, and others, that if we take that seriously, what we're talking about now is this four powers concept. And I think a very beautiful example of that would be you and Stefan meeting at some point in the near future in Central Asia, having traveled, you going through the Bering Strait Tunnel, and Stefan across the expanse of Russia on high-speed rails, which at this point may have to be built by the Chinese. But what is your vision? When you organize in San Francisco, what is your vision? How do you bring this four-power idea and this concept of the future to the people you're organizing?
What was beautiful, and this is one of the points that Mr. LaRouche brought to my attention, is that when we go out and we talk to people in Chinatown and a huge Asian population and huge, even larger, the largest portion of the Asian population is Chinese, when you talk to this population, which has direct ties to mainland China, you get a sense that you're talking to someone who's making your life better by having spoken with them, because they have this is the second generation that the Chinese population has been engaged in the development of their society through massive development projects that mirror what the North American Water and Power Alliance would be for North America. And when you bring up Nawapa, you get a response from the Asian community there where they start talking about an analogous development of bringing water from the southern region of China upward. And this is something that's been ongoing for them, so they have a very clear concept of moving mountains, changing things, which is a concept that I've only been told we had under Kennedy when we said we could accomplish just about anything and the world was going to be ours for the taking. And the view that we've got here as a campaign and what I'm pushing for personally is to say that this San Francisco, this should be revived as a key point for the development of all of North America. And this is all the other six campaigns as a North American developmental region, that this will be the starting point for reaching out to the nations of Asia and the development that will go all the way up to the Bering Strait, and including a Bering Strait tunnel. And then we will have the capacity to be able to go, myself and Stefan, to meet each other somewhere out there in Central Asia, perhaps once Nawapa has been completed and you have the development of, hopefully sooner, the development of this south-north development in China. Maybe we can meet in Mongolia, where they'll have a newly developed capability and mining resource capacity.
Now, Stefan, let me come back to one of the crisis points in the world today, which is as a result of the hyperinflation of the economy and the prices in food and the destabilizations that come from that, we're seeing a danger of chaos being unleashed in Egypt. Now, as you know, the European Union has put forward this idea of paving over some of the Sahara and creating Desertec, an area of solar panels. I mean, it's a completely insane idea. But at the same time, Lyndon LaRouche has put forward a perspective of the development of the Nile region, the Qatara Depression, and connecting that with the Trans-Aqua Project, which I'm assuming is also a major part of the way that we're showing people in your campaigns what we could do if we broke with the British Empire's monetarism and went back to a credit system. Given that the German government is now echoing Obama, saying Mubarak has to go, this is a rather urgent situation, and I'd like you to say something about that.
Well, for sure. I think I don't know how long they can actually do that, or I'm as of this moment not quite sure of what the discussion really is in the German government, because obviously they're putting out one line, but then they've done that with other things, and we have in other cases also known that there was a different perception and different discussions than what was officially put out,
including on the euro.
Yeah, but then no, I think the question of what role Germany would play vis-a-vis other countries, especially in Africa, simply has to be put back into reality, because right now it's this European policy, and since Merkel and some others somehow are either under intense pressure or have some kind of internal desire to be more obedient than they were even asked to be in trying to join this. I mean, the discussion now is about this, the formation of a European economic government.
Right.
In other words, Merkel said that the pension age, social systems, and all of these things should be equalized between the various countries of the European Union and the Eurozone. Now, this is obviously crazy, and the only thing that really makes sense is to, as you said, to counter it with a vision that will actually give people the power to imagine in their own minds how that would change something. And right now, talking about changing or democratizing Egypt and things like that, yeah, there may be people who are in favor of that, but you know, you cannot think about something like this and seriously believe that this is going to help and improve people's lives over there. I really don't think so. And anyone who's honest would probably agree. And I think when you say you cannot eat democracy, that probably sums it up best, because the people need bread. They need food. They need a functioning agriculture. And, you know, the only line that really is against this is this whole British-style free trade, you know, creating international markets where countries, instead of growing their own food, grow food for export. And then, you know, I mean, Egypt and others who had been exporting, or you think about Tunisia, the countries that export food to the world market and then have their own population starving. I mean, how perverse is that? So that really has to change. But I would just in terms of what Summer said before, which I find very inspiring, because I think with this kind of, with the same eye that, you know, he has just given the idea of the trans-Pacific world into Asia, the Bering Strait, I mean, the same thing is for Africa. And often in organizing, I told people, just imagine what Africa would be if, for instance, you wanted to study medicine and you would know that the best university to study medicine is, for instance, in Harare, you know, and Zimbabwe. Or you would think about an African space program, or you would think about the fact that, you know, Africa, which is such an enormous continent with so many beautiful countries, with beautiful landscapes, that the countries there, if actually developed, would be something that you would desire to visit. You want to go there, you want to, you know, see these things. And in the same vein, I think about space, you know, the development that we've often discussed, going to moon, going to Mars, because, I mean, we know how vast the universe is, but we know very little about it yet. So, mm-hmm. And giving big perspectives, like this, the Trans-Aqua plan, of telling people we're going to use our creativity to recreate a lake. And to actually, you know, create a biosphere and manage it for the best of people, but also nature. I mean, it's very inspiring. And nobody wants these stupid solar panels. And by the way, they also, you know, the discussion now is obviously also not to save the cost on putting an energy grid of 5,000 kilometers from northern Africa into Europe, which was crazy enough. And now the discussion is that in order for Africa to use the electricity that's being produced there, they're going to supply Europe with gas and oil.
And then the Africans can use the solar power.
Yeah. I mean, this is insane.
Well, it's also known as colonialism.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, hopefully the nations of North Africa, if they are having an awakening, will decide to throw out once and for all British imperial policy. And your campaign and our slate in the United States can help realize that. Stefan, if people want to see what we're doing with the campaigns, why don't you give out the website where they can go? It helps if you speak German, but you can at least get a sense of what we're doing otherwise. Where should people look for this?
Sure. I mean, our website is BUESO, which is BUESO.DE for Deutschland, Germany. And when you go on there, I mean, it's even if you don't speak German, it's easy to find. And you'll see immediately from the icons where the videos are. And you can just get an impression of what this is. And if you really want to have some fun, compare it to these lame-ass, stupid, boring, but good-looking websites of other parties in Germany, and you'll really have a fun time, because they have nothing to say. So they have to, you know, spend their time with balloons and icons and giving people pens. And
well, and I would say to our listeners that your campaign and the campaign in Baden-Württemberg and Rheinland-Pfalz are not just campaigns in Germany, but as you've pointed out, they're campaigns for the human race. They're campaigns for America also. And Americans have a vested interest in what you do. So I would encourage people to use this introduction to these campaigns as an opportunity to educate yourself on the nature of this fight internationally and what we have to do. And Summer, I know we have this candidates roundtable that you participated in. And you've been continuing to put out statements, have you not?
Yep, we'll continue. I have been, and we will still continue. And you can find them all on LaRouchePAC.com.
And I would urge people to go to LaRouchePAC.com. You can also see a very short video with Stefan, which includes at least the audio, mm-hmm. the very beautiful audio of the choral fantasy of Ludwig von Beethoven that Stefan mentioned earlier. Look, this Angelides report, we also have quite a bit of material on this up on our website. Read the report. Go to fcic.com, get the report, read the conclusion, and you'll see that this report demonstrates that every warning Lyndon LaRouche gave over the last 40 years was right, that they're telling the truth with this commission, and we need Glass-Steagall if we're going to survive. And so, Stefan and Summer, thanks for joining us today. We've run out of time. Mm-hmm. Join us again next week on The LaRouche Show, 3 p.m. Eastern Time.
Thank you, Harley. Thanks, Summer.
Thank you. Thank you, Harley. Thank you, Stefan.